Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Pull up a pew and have a brew, everybody. Woo! Welcome to Superfan Chats, show where we all get together, the super fans of No Small Roles, and talk about all the stuff that the Fate Marked Five or the Abraca Lads have been up to since we last checked in. I am Superfan Han, one of the Superfan Hans, and today I am joined by the lovely
Superfan Alice.
That was an amazing pause.
That pause should stay.
The right amount of curiosity about, is that my name?
There's no video of this, but Hannah literally gestured and there was just a long pause. And I was sitting here like, wait, am I the lovely one? Should I go in?
You're both very lovely. It was just sort of like, go for it. I guess we should have decided that before as well. So yes, I am joined by Superfan Alice, and also, if you haven't guessed already, the equally lovely
Ben Galpin.
Oh my god, Ben, you've changed your hair since I've seen you.
Yeah, I'm also practicing an American accent for this.
Well, you have been there. That's where you were.
Yeah, well, I'm planning to move over there full time. And start a film career. Yeah, that's the goal.
Amazing.
Oh, nice one.
Tell us how it goes. Keep us updated.
I will. But I'm also doing a very convincing impression right now of Superfan Jeremy.
Yes. It's incredible.
He's the one here.
The acting skills are on point. Really amazing.
Hollywood is going to open its doors. That's all I can say.
I truly believe this is the case. So on today's episode, we are going to be discussing the antics in episodes 76 to 78 of No Small Roles. So if you haven't listened to that already, either go back and do that or be okay with some mega spoilers, because that's all we're going to be chatting about. I'm not quite sure why you would listen to this if you didn't want those episodes spoiled. So
you've been warned. Maybe it's like Critical Role and they fell behind and now they feel a little overwhelmed. So they're listening to our recaps and analyses in order to understand what happened in those episodes.
Actually,
to get themselves
point.
Current.
That's a good point, yeah. Because yeah, that's exactly nice. Where I am with Critical Role right now. I think I'm like 20 episodes behind and I'm like, this is so many hours of content. How am I ever going to catch up?
That's 80 hours. That is 80 hours
I know,
of Critical
like,
Role.
What if I put headphones in and just like play it while I'm asleep? Do you think I will absorb the storyline?
You start dreaming about it?
Yeah. Just dreaming I'm one of them. Like Matt, what do I have to do?
How do you want to do this? It's like you're being chased through your dreams by Matt Mercer. Like, how do you want to do this? How do you want to do this? And he just keeps making weird sound effects.
Yeah.
It's just like, they're so convincing. It's so scary.
Waking up.
You have a D20 in your lap. Like as you wake up.
Where did this come from? Yes, that is exactly what is happening. I was the one who was going to take the recap of episode 76, so I could kick us off if everyone
do it
All right.
Hey, I'm a soccer ball. Kick me.
So, episode 76. Do we remember what episode 76 is called?
Breakfast Bouquets.
Thank you, Alice.
I didn't realize we were doing titles. I'm
like stalling while I scroll back through my podcast feed. Yes. Breakfast Bouquets, episode 76. Breakfast Bouquets. So, returning to the Swan Inn, Gwendolyn drunkenly passes out whilst Juno caught Enkidu up with everything that had occurred since the Twain Tide Tea Tournament Festival, including the revelations about Carhilda, all while tattooing him with a sending spell. With Gaius returning from his tryst with Eustace, the party rested and spent the morning preparing for the journey ahead. Enkidu used his sending tattoo to reach out to Scarpus. Eustace bid farewell to Gaius with a bunch of flowers which turned into butterflies. And Gwendolyn and Juno used a divination spell to learn that the dangerous omens of the Carhilda name were entirely up for interpretation. They looked at the Crownswood map that Enkidu had been given, discussed the local advice and decided which paths to take. As they all readied themselves to leave, Juno quickly scried on Gwendolyn's mother, Sigrid, discovering she was in the Dravanian royal palace. The scry was interrupted by the Petra-possessed Orin hiding in the bushes of the royal palace. With some quick sendings to confirm that Petra was attempting to gather allies, seemingly including Sigrid, they all packed up and made their way out of the Swan Inn. Quite a fun episode, that one.
Mm. Yeah, I like it when they're drunk. Mm.
Stuff always seems to go down.
When you put this group with alcohol, it is it's always a delight.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Although I feel like Juno drunk is very much like Juno sober.
Yes.
Yeah.
Similar vibe every time.
Yeah. I get the sense that Juno's one of those people that's quite good at holding her drink, and you can't tell until she's like so unbelievably hammered that it's impossible to hide any of it anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think June is a tank.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. The wrinkles give her more endurance. She just stores all the alcohol in the wrinkles.
Kind of soaks it all up.
Yeah. By the end, she's completely smooth skinned. That's how you know she's really drunk, is when all the wrinkles have been smoothed out and she's 5 feet tall. I find the continued information about the Carhilda name to be a very interesting, like, that is a fascinating plot line, and it's yet another plot line that I'm like, man, this could be like a whole 20-30 episode arc. It, you know what I mean? It feels like to like go and like, we have to go and confront all of the orcs and get to the bottom of the, like, that's what that feels like to me. There's so many like storylines for each character that feel like they could have long arcs unto themselves. Another thing, until I saw it written down, I had no idea, because of the non-rhotic nature of the English accent, that Carhilda is actually Carhilder.
Yes. I actually needed to see it written down to figure out how it was spelled, because that is not how it was spelled in my mind.
Because you don't hear the R's.
No.
Definitely didn't hear the R on the end. That was unexpected.
Yeah, that was really interesting. I think I had this idea that it was spelled more like in a sort of like romance language kind of way, rather than this very almost...
Nordic?
Yeah, like Nordic, like, or kind sort of Russian, kind of like quite hard stops in the way it looks. But fascinating. So this was sort of wrapping up a little bit of the information from the previous episode, obviously, which was like when Gwendolyn was drunk and the whole interacting with the Orkosh, the people from Orkosh, and the whole Carhilda finding out that it does produce a very strong reaction. And I did feel a little bit vindicated, because I feel like I said a while ago, she doesn't know what this name means, so her using it everywhere could be a little dangerous. So I felt a little bit smug on that one.
I think you're right. I seem to remember you saying that as well. Yeah, you're right on the money.
But just, I mean, well, because I was also like, she keeps telling everyone she's Gwendolyn Rose as well, and there are people after her. So I think my sense of, maybe it's just I'm very paranoid and I have a very heightened sense of danger. So that, but that whole revelation, I agree, about Carhilda and what it means, but also the fact that it's a name with like an omen attached to it, but an omen that is very subjective in its interpretation and could almost be like swayed by people's actions as well as fate, was such a fascinating concept.
Yeah. No, I think it's really exciting. I'm not getting away quickly from the fact that I think it basically means she's a vampire slayer. And, you know, I just think it's such a cool thing. Just the idea that it's sort of a destiny thing and it could be bad and it could be good. It just, I'm not going to stop tooting this horn. Because there's something so exciting about the idea that there have been past Carhildas and there could be stories about that. You know, there could be an entire arc about the first Carhilda or something. I just want to know all the stories. I'm looking forward to them finding out these folk tales. Who knows where they'll get
like
them
from. Like a mini-series?
Yes!
Like a whole Carhilda mini-series?
So good. Yes.
Yeah. Who would you want to be in that? Would you want the main cast to be in it? Ooh. Or would you want like guests to come and do it and then the main cast have to listen to the episode to find out?
Oh, that would be amazing. Fun. Because would it be like a one-shot about the one of the earlier Carhildas and like the creation of a folktale about a Carhilda that they then encounter as they gather more information in the main campaign, in which case it would probably have to be like quite guest heavy in many ways. Or would it be like a quest to find out more about Carhildas and therefore the main cast could probably do like a bit more of like a side one shot type thing?
I like the idea of doing a special thing where the main cast keep finding evidence of stuff that contradicts itself. And each time they read like a different story or a different piece of evidence, that little section is like a 10-minute vignette that's played out by guests. So David is telling them the story in the moment, and then they sort of edit in his narration over like a couple of the scenes and stuff like that. I think that could be pretty
cool. I love that.
Oh my god, that'd be so cool. Like little like taking other games and using them as flashbacks in the main campaign. That would be so basically what you're saying, Jeremy, is both.
Yes, exactly. ¿Por qué no los dos? Let's combine them.
I love it. Why not? Indeed.
Bonus points for the idea of vignettes and the word vignette, which I really like. So yeah, it's such a good idea.
Thank you. Also, I wanted to throw out
could
there,
we cast it with super fans?
Yeah, draft the super fans in to be the flashback people.
Whoop, 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 yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to say one other thing is the spelling of Carhilda makes a lot more sense of the way they were pronouncing it on the show. Because they've been hitting the Ka way harder than I would have expected. Because I think similar to you, Hannah, I was imagining C-A-H-I-L-D-A. Yeah. That like Carhilda.
Yeah.
That would be pronounced Carhilda. It wouldn't be pronounced Carhilda, it would be Carhilda.
Yeah.
And so every time they'd hit the Carhilda, I was like, this is an odd way of pronouncing that. Yeah. And now I look at it, I'm like, oh, it's because it's not Ka, it's Car.
Yeah.
It's Carhilda.
Yeah. And I really expected it to have like an E on the end. Like even Hilda spelt like instead of with an A on the end, with like an E on the end, like a very kind of, you know, French Germanic kind of quite lovely, soft. Nope.
Yeah, not even like, ER, just an R.
Yeah, which is really interesting because of it. I feel like David's doing an amazing job of giving a real flavor of all the different cultures in such different ways, like right the way down to the way their languages and their names would be spelled. And that is like another way that I feel like his storytelling is so rich.
That is like an Orkoshian, would it be Orkoshian? I think Orkoshian name or Akashian name.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
And it just gives you this sense of, like, the way they speak in Orkosh. It gives you a sense of, like, what their culture might be like just through a name, which is so interesting. Yeah. And, yeah, so clever.
They had, like, the Orkosh or the Orkosian woman who was in the Shattered Runes talking, and she sounded a bit kind of Russian-y when she was talking. So yeah, that makes sense.
That would make sense then.
Yeah, I get the sense that it does have sort of influences from like kind of Russia, Eastern Europe, sort of
like Slavic stuff.
Yeah, yeah, sort of Slavic or Balkan, or you know, there's something about it that seems really interesting in that way. I would love for them to go to Orkosh. Oh my gosh, that would be so fun.
Orkosh. There was, okay, so there was, this is off topic, but what you just reminded me, there was a store when I was a little kid, I think it was a kid's clothing store called Oshkosh Bagosh.
Yep.
And yeah, and you saying that, I'm like, Orkosh Bagosh. Yeah. Or because you were like, Orkosh, oh my gosh. And I was like, ah! That would be, go to Orkosh, oh my gosh. Like
the name of the mini campaign.
Orkosh Bagosh.
Ah, yes.
Can I make a formal request that there is a line of clothing stores in Orkosh called Orkosh Bagosh?
Yeah,
for orc children.
David, please honor this request.
Yeah, they have like little tusk warmers that like you could put on your child, so because they, you know, they're still learning how to use their tusks.
Oh my God.
You don't want them to be crunching on everyone and everything because that can cause serious injury. So you put like little mittens on to sort of blunt their ability to bite.
That would be amazing. That would be amazing. I love it. The little fantasy dungarees.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing about episode 76, to slightly bring it back to where we started, maybe, was just the adorable interactions between Gaius and Eustace.
Yeah.
I was just about to mention that.
Oh my God. I loved that so much. It was, they were both so kind and sweet to each other, even though it was very clear neither of them wanted more than like a one night stand. It was a bit like, if you're ever in town again. But it just seemed so like very tender and respectful. It was just really lovely.
Yeah, it was very sweet. I was surprised by how coy Eustace was in the morning. Like, I guess because he's sort of a bit older, I just kind of assumed he'd be cooler than that. But no, he was just really like embarrassed and had clearly had a lovely time. It was very sweet.
Yeah, I kind of ship it. I kind of hope we gotta. I feel like I want these people to all be in relationships by the end of the series, or unless they don't want to. But still, like. I don't know. I feel like it would be nice for Gaius to have like a boyfriend that he could be messaging back and forth with as he travels around. I think it'd be really cute.
Yeah, it would be lovely.
I feel like if he had a relationship, it would be extraordinarily open. But yes, it would be nice if he had like one guy that he went back to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sort of his primary, I guess, I think is the term.
Yeah.
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 Deciding Gaius's polycule already.
Who else would we add? who else is joining this polycule? So. what other NPCs or PCs would we add to this polycule? I don't think Enkidu is going that way. Like I just don't get that vibe between the two of them.
No, but you know what? The Gwenkidu fodder they have been putting into these episodes is making me like, when is this going to happen? Because it's inevitable.
But also,
him.
There's still some dwindling, as we'll see in the next episode. There's still some dwindling going
well,
on.
Well, yes, that's true. But Gwen, Enkidu, like, slipping over as he's trying to look cool about Gwen kissing a lot of people was incredibly awkward and the stuff of all rom-coms. It was great.
My heart.
He really is a Mr. Darcy type, isn't he?
Yes.
Unbelievably like very silent and repressed.
Yeah, and very, like, stiff and, like, weirdly judgmental, but also, once you get past it, not at all.
Yeah.
Like, he just has a strong ethical system and sometimes rushes to snap judgments.
Yeah, and, like, super formal and concerned with etiquette, and then also wildly impulsive at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mr. Enki Darcy.
Yeah!
Who would Gwendolyn be? What would she... I'm trying to think of Gwen Elizabeth. I don't know if it fits.
Yeah, I mean, Grace has said that she's based her off sort of Austen type heroines, I think, before, which makes a lot of sense, you know, with the way of decorum and stuff. So if we're finding Gwendolyn's Mr. Darcy to her Lizzie Bennet, why not?
Although I'd say she's more like Marianne from Sense and Sensibility, maybe, or Catherine Morland from Northanger Abbey, potentially, just because she doesn't have Lizzie's solidity. There's something very like, I am young and passionate about Gwen.
Alice, I'm going to level with you. I have strayed into literary territory I am not that familiar with. I don't know very much Jane Austen. So I'm going to take your word for that as someone who has probably read way more than I have.
I haven't read the other books, but I have read Pride and Prejudice, and I do understand what you're saying about the differences between Lizzie and Gwendolyn. That, yeah, Lizzie seems very sure of herself a lot of the time, and is very like, she's self-assured, and Gwendolyn is much more like, I'm new to all of this, just experimenting, having fun, learning about the world and me.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, she is sweet when she does that, though, especially when she's like, I'm going to get drunk. I'm going to dance and kiss lots of people.
Yeah, I wasn't sure about like Guy's idea of being supportive was just like complimenting her on her kissing ability. I can't think of anything that would make me more embarrassed than someone going, oh yeah, you were doing a great job, well done.
Oh, the cringe.
Excellent kisser, top notch.
I know.
I suppose she is like that sort of early 20s, you know, like uni student age, where people do kind of go out and experiment and end up, you know, seeing the world after a life of, you know, maybe a bit more like a bit more sheltered.
Yeah,
being a bit more sheltered. And it's nice to see her, you know, it did make me think of like going to the student union and having a dance with all the people and like making out with, do you know what I mean? Like, that seemed like a very early 20s experience that was quite recognizable.
Yeah, I agree. I wanted to throw out there, how many glimpses of this now that we, how many glimpses rather have we had of Gwendolyn's mother?
Not many.
Because like her mother has been sort of absent from the narrative, right?
Yeah.
She has, you know, there's all this mystery. Her mom gave her that name. There's all this stuff. Her mom's off doing other stuff. We've seen her dad. We've seen her sister. You know, we've seen sort of her mentor. But it's very, like, Sigrid has been very absentee from Gwendolyn and from the narrative. Like, there's been lots of mentions of her. But how many times have we seen her? Is this the first time?
I think this is number one. I can't remember another time where we saw her like in a significant way. And in this episode, we didn't just see her. We saw Oren interacting with her, or Petra as Oren, controlling Oren interacting with her, which was so wild at the end of the episode. That was an episode ending where I was like, what? What is this?
Yeah.
What's going on? I have to listen to the next one immediately.
That is so, yeah, I'm right there with you. That is, like, what? Also, and this is slight spoiler for episode, I think, 80?
Yeah.
I may or may not have recorded a little thing with Oren that takes place towards the end of this period in his life, and I had no context for what he had been up to. So me finding out, like, wait, you were talking to Gwen's mom? What?
Yes.
That's wild.
Of course, because when, again, alluding to the future episodes without spoiling too much or getting into it too much, yeah, because when Dwayne meets Oren, and I suppose it's just an Orcosh woman who's there. There's no context for who that is, and I don't even know if Oren would have much context for who that is. Because would he know Gwendolyn's mum's name, like, directly? Nope. Or would he know...
No, because no, they talked about it in this one, and no one else knew it apart from Juna and Gwen. So there's no reason why Oren would know it.
So he's had an interaction with Gwen's mum without actually knowing that's what he did.
Yeah.
Doesn't she look like Gwendolyn, though? Like, you gotta think, right? There's gotta be some sort of resemblance.
Although I guess she's like full orc and Gwen is half orc,
that's quite different. I mean, how strong
would
the resemblance be? Maybe she looks more like her dad. I don't know.
No,
it's true. She could actually take after her dad in her features. I don't know. Like, did because Yeah, I'm just thinking, like, okay, how many orcs have, like, grayish skin? I imagine her mom is more jacked than Gwendolyn is. Like, yeah. Just generally bulkier, probably a little taller.
Yeah.
Maybe and her she tusks has are longer.
Yeah.
White hair instead of green hair, so that's confusing.
That's true.
It would be hard to know. I can't wait to see how or whether it all gets put together. Making the connections. It's the thing that David does so well about setting up these massive revelations in ways that will lead to even more massive revelations down the line, where they like build on each other, but you don't actually know when they're going to connect with something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like Critical Role, except every episode is in 4 hours.
Yes, which sometimes I'm like, why isn't there more of this? Then other times I'm like, oh, thank God I can catch up.
Yeah, and then there's super fan chats to help you catch up if you feel overwhelmed to listen to the actual episodes. But you should go listen to the episodes on your own time when you have the chance.
Absolutely.
Because this stretch of episodes is delightful.
It's so good. It's so, so good.
Mildly traumatizing, but that comes later.
Yes. And
that's not until like the end of episode 77. Yeah. And then into 78.
Well, before we move on to episode 77, can I also just flag the whole Enkidu messaging Scarpus?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Neither of them could do word counts. It was adorable. I just loved them both getting cut off halfway through a sentence.
It's just, yeah. That was very, just another, again, another one of those moments that it just gives you such an insight into how rich each individual character's story is within this world, and how much there is. I want to find out so much more about all of it.
It's a real testament to the players and to David for creating a very lush world and very lived in characters who develop as well very believably and continue to form more and more connections.
Absolutely.
Where is Scarpus? Did we know
did
that
they say
No, I was just wondering.
I don't think so.
No, I think
sure.
he just, I think he, I don't know. Because he just used the sending.
Yeah.
I didn't have a clear sense.
Yeah. And I don't think he said.
I just wondered if we could see them, because she's got to be a good repository for stories as much as anything.
Yeah. Well, anyway, episode 77.
I was going to say, should we chat about the next bit while we all ponder?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's continue pondering as I give a brief summary of episode 77. Episode 77, because we're doing episode titles now, is called The Crown's Wood. That's right, The Crown's Wood. This is kind of another light and happy, for the most part, episode, or just sort of fun and interesting, like, oh, we're goofing until the end. So, heading into The Crown's Wood on the backs of their new horses, Clanius. Is it Clanius? Clanius?
Clanius. I think it's
Clanius.
Isn't it Clanius?
I think it should be Clanius.
Oh, man.
Because the way, look, once again, I see the spelling, and I don't think I-U-S should be pronounced Eus. I think it should be pronounced Eus. And because of the E-I, I feel like it should be Clanius.
Yeah.
Or Clanius. I'm just saying. Come at me. Come at me, Cass.
It's a fantasy world. We can say what we want.
Yeah. Rouge, Starlight, and Tubes.
Oh, my God.
Maybe I mispronounced those Tubes.
We'll get to that in a minute. Sorry, I'll stop interrupting your recap.
No, absolutely. And the party mused on their experiences with nature growing up, discussed the ethics of eating rabbits. There was a little bit of hunting that took place, including a full-on critical hit on a rabbit. So it died very quickly, and presumably painlessly. With concern from Gwendolyn, Juna contacted Farazine and found that she and Myra were near to Priden, with only a little trouble caused along the way. After a failed attempt to scry on the dwarven member of the Children of Havoc, Judah is scry happy, by the way, just throwing that out there. She is unbound and is scrying on everyone. Juna looked in on Dwayne.
Hey!
Yeah, to find him lingering pensively on a balcony somewhere in Aeland. And then we had a little sending conversation with a little Dwayne cameo. I think Juna said, "Don't drink the milk."
Yeah,
which is I forgot I'd even said that ever. until they sent me that. I was like, "Ah, Good times. So there was a little sending, teasing. And on the second night in the woods, there was a host of small, like tiny lights that appeared on the side of the road. Enkidu and Gaius were charmed immediately and drawn closer to them. And they were trying, the party tried to pull each other away from the lights, hold each other back, but they were caught in a sticky trap and swarmed by skittering insects. They were fighting off the biting bugs, and they did manage to escape the swarm, itchy but alive. But as the day continued, so did the itching for Gwendolyn and Gaius, whose bug bites were now eerily glowing.
And that's when it got real gross.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fight wasn't good for me. I didn't enjoy feeling itchy for a good half hour, like however long the fight took. The whole thing was like, oh God, they're on me. Sorry.
It was pretty yucky on a sensory perspective.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I loved it. I like it when stories make me uncomfortable. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, have a swarm of weird parasitic fireflies. This is a great idea. I'm so on board with this.
I feel alive. I'm feeling something.
Yeah. Exactly. Yes. Harder. Make it worse. Yeah, that was. I've had similar combats that I've run in some of my home games. And my goal is always to have everyone either feel alive or have them audibly gag. That's the goal. And yeah, this was suitably gross. Thank you, David.
It was very effective in its aims of grossness and creepiness. So it was a very, very visceral feeling that I got listening to it as well, which I don't know if I enjoyed as much as you did, Jeremy, but I definitely appreciate it. Alice is like, nope. Hard nope.
I had to listen to it all on double time when I was re-listening to it just so I could get through it.
That's fair.
Yeah.
That's fair. Yeah.
But there was some fun bits in the fight.
I like the fact that they were fireflies.
Yes, that was cool.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
There was some fun bits in it. Like Guy pulling him and Juna through the dimension door and falling out onto the road was like a really cool image. That was really fun. Mm-hmm. And like the idea of fighting something that's on people, so you have to be really careful, is really inventive. It just means that they have to think really carefully about what they're using, otherwise they might hit each other, which I think happened.
Mm. Yeah, it's not just another combat. It's like they have to start being really creative with what they're doing, and their actions could have even more severe consequences than, like, I don't know, accidentally making elemental stronger.
Who would do that?
By attacking it with its very same element. And also the horse dies.
Oh, why?
Yeah.
Bessie.
I loved the little Dwayne cameo. It was so nice. And it was so nice to have your voice in it as well, Jeremy, rather than it being like David doing an impression of Dwayne. It was so nice to actually have the audio in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, every time they hit me up and they're like, hey, could you record like a tiny little thing for Dwayne? I'm always like, oh, yeah.
Oh, that's so fun.
And it's usually like little voice snippets. It's usually like record like a 1 to 2 minute little thing. And I'm always like, oh, boy, I can't wait to see where this shows up.
It's so cute. It's so cute. And it's so funny as well, because like that's so much like Dwayne getting these little sendings just out of the blue. Like,
he doesn't have any context.
Here's a message. Respond.
Imagine Dwayne doing this in the middle of like the continuing adventures. Like, he's in the middle of like these really emotional moments, and then suddenly getting like, hey Dwayne, don't drink the milk. He's like trying to pour out his heart. I'm like, my dead husband, or he's not husband, but boyfriend, all this stuff.
Yeah, I do wonder about that with their sendings, and also the scrying. Like you said, Juna is going, she is so nosy. She's like, I'm going to scry on everyone. I'm going to detect all their thoughts. I'm going to dig around in their brains and look at what they're doing. She is becoming a bit of a peeping Tom.
She's always been like this. Mm. Come on. It's not a new thing.
Yeah, but now it's got worse because she's got
more power
to do more of it.
She's always been a peeping Tom.
She's just got more abilities to really indulge that side of her, to be so nosy.
I wonder, is there anything that... You know what? I think Dwayne may have to like learn non-detection at some point. He may need to learn the non-detection spell just to avoid Juna from scrying on him.
Yeah, or find some kind of magic item that like prevents you from being discovered in any way or scried on in any way. Because otherwise she's going to drop in at a really inopportune moment. Yeah, and
like you're on the toilet. And just like reading a book.
Yeah. Reading a scroll you get on the toilet.
You get ascending that's like the third time you've been reading that book. Like you've been stuck on that page.
Never gonna finish it.
3 months now. Just give it up. Go read. I think you're just not a reader. Just give it up. And you're just like,
I wouldn't put it past Juna either.
No, I'm surprised that she didn't scry on Guy and Eustace just to, you know, just for a cheap thrill.
Like, there's part of me that's wild. Like, no, she wouldn't cross that line. And then there's another part of me that's like, she would.
She might.
Her boundaries, you know, is she for the light, the dark, or the balance, or just the really, really curious?
This could be an indication of the balance where like because scrying is not an inherently bad thing. Neither is detect thoughts. They are sort of violating somebody's privacy, but sometimes that's necessary if you're like, oh, for example, you're like, wait, what about Gwendolyn's long lost mother? Can we find out like what happened to her? Or if you're genuinely worried about somebody or if like, okay, in the case of Dwayne, she saw Dwayne as potentially a threat to Gwendolyn in some way. Like, he had broken her heart, you know, he mistreated her and was this super slick dude, so she didn't trust him. So it's understandable that she would then read his mind to try and, like, because that's her version, I guess, of doing a background check.
Yeah.
She tried to check his thoughts.
Yeah. Just really, like, you know, trying to see what his intentions are. And, you know, she usually does it in the service of, like, protecting someone else or trying to set up more protection for her loved ones or see how they're doing or yeah, like check in on them, you know, in quite a nurturing kind of way. Man, it's beginning to slightly edge out of that territory, I feel.
Well, it's nice to see her kind of being a lot more relaxed with Dwayne instead of, you know, shouting at him. So that's nice.
Yeah. Definitely nicer for Dwayne.
Yeah.
Although even still, his main memory of Juna is she yelled at him a bunch and then she randomly messages him sometimes.
Yeah.
So that's like every time he gets a message, he's sort of like, okay. Well, hey, hello.
Please don't yell at me again.
And I should also say, in Juna's defense, this was Gwendolyn's idea. I think Gwendolyn requested that Juna scry on Dwayne. Which is what I'm saying. The Dwendolyn Fabulosa, those the ship continues to sail.
It does. It really does.
It's difficult to say, but it's easy to ship.
Dwendolyn Fabulosa. There we go. We got
there. Oh, we've got Gwen Kidu. We've got Dwendolyn. It's like, which way is it going to go? Is there going to be a gentlemanly duel?
Oh.
It could go both ways.
Yeah,
it's true.
It could just be that both of them are like, yeah, I'm cool with it.
I feel like Gwendolyn and Dwayne would be down with that. I'm not sure about Enkidu. I'm not quite sure where he would stand on that one.
He's already got a lot of people in his head.
He's very surprising. Oh, that's true. If someone dates Enkidu, is that automatically a polycule?
Oh,
that's true. Well, at the very least, there's a lot of other people just hanging out.
Yeah.
Like every single date, it's just like what, six other people? Just like
one of them might
like murder chilling
you.
There, like, hey. Hey. One of them like takes over and is like, hey, I just want to let you know, we really do not appreciate the way that you were treating Enkidu. And I would like to know, what are your intentions?
Yeah. Oh, which one would that be?
I wonder if it would be someone like Hina.
Yeah.
Being like, excuse me. Just like to know a bit more about what you're planning with my good friend Enkidu.
Yeah.
What's going
my
on?
My good friend and body.
My host.
What are your intentions? That would be hilarious. I love the idea of Enkidu meeting with all of his friends inside of his head and having like them be like, look, I don't like him. I'm just going to be honest. I don't like him.
Or like giving him like a rundown of how he did on a date. Like, oh man, you really fumbled that one.
Oh, brutal.
It was going so well.
What did you hold her hand?
You didn't see how much he was trying to touch your arm. What's going on?
Should have gone for the kiss on the cheek, bro. Should have gone for the kiss on the cheek. It was too early for the lips. Now it's weird.
When someone says, would you like to come in for coffee? That means they want you to come in for coffee so you can hang out with them.
Nod. Also, like, I imagine if he actually gets into a relationship, as soon as he goes in, they're all like, Abraca, lads, like, just surrounding him. It's like, yeah, way to go. But also, that would just be so weird. Maybe that's why. I'd have to ask Daryl if Enkidu feels reluctant to get into a relationship because there's so many other people always present for it.
Yeah.
Because that's got to be weird.
Yeah, that would make it really strange just to know that all these people would, like, have an awareness of what you're doing. Like, no privacy. Non-existent. And yeah, also now, like, with the Erida situation too.
That's
true.
A whole other thing.
How much does she know? How much is being recorded?
Probably everything. I'm now imagining, like, what are you thinking? Like, what are you thinking about? I'm sorry, that information is reserved for high-ranking family members.
I mean, that would be a really, really great way to get out of that conversation, wouldn't it?
And possibly the relationship as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree. I think Dwayne would probably want, like, a romantic courtship. Initially, like, a one-on-one situation where it's like a romantic courtship, and then once it's like, oh, we're in a relationship, then it's like, oh yeah, no, go have fun.
Yeah,
like, let's communicate openly, I guess, but like, let's I don't know, I'm cool with it.
I mean, he's also a dragon, so he's lived a long time, so I can imagine wanting to experiment with more than monogamy might be interesting. You got a lot of years to see what different types of relationships are like. You know, I can't
it's
imagine,
true.
You know, that might change your perspective on things slightly.
What happens if he meets like some really hot dragon that he's into, and he's like, yo, but the dragon can't yet turn into like a humanoid form. So he's like, I have this dragon relationship over here. And then I have my humanoid relationship over here. And it's great.
Like, I'm really enjoying this discussion of, like, the logistics of fantasy dating. Like, how would it work? How would it work? If you're a dragon, and, you know, if you've got multiple people inside your head, how does this work?
And, you know, bringing it back to the episode, fantasy dating, isn't that just what the swarm was doing? They need to reproduce one way or another. That's how it goes. This is how they do it. It's a fantasy date. The party did, there was romantic lighting.
There was charm. There was setting the mood.
They really brought the charm.
There was drawing them in.
There was penetration.
Oh, God. There was. And it was. And then there was the next day.
Yes.
The morning after.
The morning after.
The walk of shame. Yeah. The entire party doing the walk of shame.
Man, if your walk of shame is itchy, that is not always a good sign.
See, there you go. Itching is always a bad sign after a date like that. Should we move on to episode 78?
Alice, I did say I would happily talk about this episode because it seems like you've...
It's cool. We're nearly there.
I wish you could all see Alice's face right now.
I'm laughing, but it hurts.
Yeah, it's half smile, half cringe.
Okay, so 78, unhealthy glow. So with Gwendolyn and Gaius incubating glowing insect eggs, the party pushed forward to reach Woodstock, hoping for healing help. However, on reaching the tavern there, the innkeeper Wib, which is an amazing name, one of my top 10 names actually, Wib, turned them away, worried that the eggs would hatch and infest his pub. He sent them on to find the Grove Mother, telling them to look out for fox statues along the road. As they set out following the northward path, Juno focused on purifying some holy water to help fight the infection. Resting for lunch, Gaius polymorphed Enkidu into a hawk to scout ahead for the fox statues, whilst Juno began the ritual to turn Ruana into a hawk as well. flying over the canopy, and Kidu spotted the statues easily before slowly circling back toward the rest of the party. As the others waited, another hawk landed nearby, and thinking it was Enkidu, Gaius ended his spell, stranding his friend somewhere in the forest. This hawk revealed itself to be the Grove Mother, who opened a pathway to her sacred grove for the whole party, reuniting them all. Turning her attention to the infections, Grove Mother Vanala? Heseldam? Vanala? Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Used Juna's holy water to burn out the bug eggs from Gaius's leg before settling down to purify more holy water for Gwendolyn. Gwendolyn prepared herself for approaching the effigy of the Wilder Queen in the centre of the grove, and with a comforting smile from the carving and the smoke from a bundle of burning twigs, she fell asleep. So this episode started badly for me. let's gloss over what happens, because it's horrific. I like the fact that everyone was just in the background going, making vomiting noises and going, ew, 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 ew. Because that's how it felt listening. It was disgusting and I hated it.
See, I didn't actually mind it. I'm not going to talk in detail about it to spare you.
Oh, God.
But I think what was so compelling about it is, like, sometimes I feel like in D&D or other RPGs, you have a fight, stuff happens, and then you have a long rest, and you're all fine again. And it's like, it's almost like it didn't happen. Like, the injuries just didn't happen, even if they were, like, life-threatening. Mm-hmm. And actually having something that happened that has a consequence that needs to be dealt with from a fight is quite nice to kind of have. I mean, not nice in terms of what it actually was, but it just adds, again, like, a really different dynamic that actually, if you have a fight, you can't just have a long rest and everyone's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. That it's going to be a bit more complicated than that, and maybe you need to think about defending yourself a bit better, or being a bit more creative or tactical about what you do in fights going forward, or the information that you know, the investigation that you try and do.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah.
That's a cool way of looking at it.
Yeah, I agree. And I do think they didn't go as graphic as they could. Like, you know what I mean? They didn't go overboard. Yeah. there are definitely, like, real life parasites that are, like, parasitic insects and so forth that are more grotesque than what was being described.
Yeah.
So, I like that they still use some restraint in terms of, like, I would have been fine with it, but I also understand that I am not most people. So I think it's good that they used some restraint, because parasites in general are a massive ick, I think, for the vast majority of humans.
Oh my God.
Just awful.
Parasites are no joke. So they did very well in the way that they handled it.
Yeah. I think Darwin said that he was quite religious, but he said that the only thing that made him not believe in God was parasitic wasps. And I think that's a good point, because those guys are horrible.
I may be incorrect about this, but I think I am correct that there are more species. There's more species of parasitic wasp than there are, like, species of anything else.
Oh, my God.
But I could be wrong about that. Really? I'm going to check this. I'm going to check that. I'm going to check that fact. But, like, a lot of parasitic wasps are, like, highly specialized to prey on specific creatures. Like, so, like, for example, in America, we have the tarantula hawk wasp, which specifically hunts tarantulas. It is a wasp that is, like, that has evolved to hunt giant spiders. Wild. And it pretty much always wins that matchup too.
I mean, that is just like the title of a horror movie. So there's a giant wasp and it hunts giant spiders. This is the concept. This is the pitch.
And the wasp isn't even that big. Like, it's not tiny, but it's bigger than you'd like. Like, it's bigger than anyone would prefer, but it's not that big. Anyway, what I was going to mention is, from a mechanical standpoint, there is a precedent for parasites in Dungeons and Dragons, specifically rot grubs. There are various ways to encounter rot grubs. I know the kobold inventor is a monster that can throw pots of them, like jars of rot grubs at people.
My God.
But you can also just encounter a swarm of rot grubs. And essentially, it is similar to other swarms of creatures. It can occupy the same space as an enemy, and can move through any opening large enough for a single individual member of the swarm. And the way that this works is, if it attacks you, it attacks a creature in the swarm space, they take 2d6 piercing damage if they hit, and the target must succeed on a DC 10 constitution saving throw or be poisoned. And then at the end of each of the targets, the poisoned target's turns, it takes 1d6 poison damage. Now, whenever the poisoned target takes fire damage, they can repeat the saving throw, ending the effect on a success. But if it ends its turn with 0 hit points, it dies.
Oh my gosh. It's definitely, it's interesting that the mechanic for that is like poison. Because it makes sense, but it doesn't quite capture, I think, what David managed to do.
Yeah, well, they had quite a hefty whack, didn't they? They were sort of taking like 10 HP every turn or something.
Whatever it was, it was bad.
It was huge. Like, yeah, if you had a bug on you, that bug would be 10 hit points, like, every turn.
Yeah.
It was, yeah, they were really serious.
Yeah. I think it was like, maybe it's that similar to parasitic wasps, they were sort of evolved to hunt humanoids.
Yeah.
And so, because certain kinds of venom are going to be, I know certainly certain kinds of poison are more effective against certain kinds of animals. Like, for example, there are fruits that humans can eat that other animals can't.
Yes.
Because they're poisonous to them, but the poison doesn't affect us.
Yeah.
I think with venom, it's a little bit different, but I think there are still, like, if the venom is specialized to target humanoid, whether it's like nerve systems or whatever, you know, whatever kind of venom it is, then it makes sense then that it would be like similar to, for example, the tarantula hawk wasp. There's a video of sort of like the successor to the crocodile hunter, this guy Coyote Peterson. He's very popular on YouTube. He also had like a
name.
Yeah, he's a really nice wholesome dude, but he's sort of like a wildlife educator who goes out into the wilderness with his cowboy hat and awesome. Shows different animals.
Awesome.
Yeah, and he had his most popular series was him going around the world and getting stung by all of the top 5 insects on the Schmidt Pain Index.
What?
The Schmidt Sting Pain Index. And one of those was the tarantula hawk. And he is like screaming in pain. The video is also very funny because his cameraman is always like, "You okay? Are you okay?" As he's like, ah! Like on the ground.
Is that the one where it's so painful all you can do is lie on the floor and scream? Like, there's literally, like, it just takes out your capacity to do any rational thinking. It's just lie on the floor, scream.
No. I don't think even for the worst one, which he would say is the executioner wasp, which wasn't even on the list.
Why do they have such horrible names?
But he got stung by the executioner. Yeah, the executioner wasp. What a name. But he, even for that one, he was still able to like grab the little cup, the little glass cup that they put the insect in and put it back on top of the bug to try and preserve it so it doesn't get hurt or get away.
Wow.
Yeah. Pink, and then he collapses to the ground with, ah! But even with that, like if that wasp stings a tarantula, the tarantula is paralyzed.
Yeah,
it just can't move. It's done. The tarantula is finished. It's not going anywhere. But with a human, it just hurts really bad.
Yeah.
So it could be that like this is specifically designed to harm humanoids, especially like whatever they're doing to humanoids is they're secreting something or injecting something that is so much worse for humanoids that it'll take you out really quickly. I don't know. I'd love to talk to David about this.
They were pretty big, bad, horrible bugs.
Yeah.
They were bad.
That was a tough fight. Like, it was really tough. And the fallout from it is just, yeah, quite quite dramatic.
They turn up to a town and they're not allowed to enter buildings. Like, it's really serious.
Yeah, real, like, plague, fear of plague kind of situation. I do love the moment where they're all sitting around and Enkidu's off as a hawk, and then another hawk appears and they're like, oh, it's Enkidu, I'll just end the spell. And I just have the image of Enkidu suddenly turning back into Enkidu in the middle of the sky. exactly.
I did just laugh
tumbling out of the air.
Oh, what a moment.
Full Hans Gruber.
What a moment. Yeah.
I must admit, I did laugh particularly hard when it was like 16 points of bludgeoning damage. It's like, oh, well, great. Well done.
Imagine Enkidu's like dragging himself like, Gaius! Also, hench chats. There were hench chats.
There were hench chats.
With the grandmother.
Yeah.
So interesting.
Back in the henge.
I really enjoyed how weird Juna gets around like grove mothers and the henge witches. Like, she's just immediately fangirling, just huge wide eyes, tell me everything, I'm so excited, you're great.
She's so awkward. I know. So cute.
Yeah, it's adorable. I think that because we don't get to see that side of Juna, where she seems like she's always kind of enthusiastic, but she's never quite so like childlike. I feel like is when it's like, oh my goodness, oh, this is so cool. Like, you know, we don't get to see that side. It's really adorable.
Yeah, because I guess she's usually in that role when she's around Gwen, which is like the more nurturing, wise figure who's, you know, like, yeah, I'm just kind of finding my path and figuring things out. And, you know, that's sort of a very like wise, quite like mindful sort of take every day as it comes kind of attitude. And then she meets people who have other knowledge or who might be like more powerful than her. And she just turns into like this, yeah, this like teenage groupie, like, oh my God, you're so amazing.
Yeah. I'm also curious because one of the things about this encounter is it felt unlike most of their encounters, like the large majority of the encounters in this campaign, it felt the most like a random encounter. I don't think it was a random encounter, but the way it happened was just they were traveling and got attacked, which is typically not, it's usually like they are in a city and they happen to witness something and then they interact with people and, you know, it's, there's pulled into a larger, this was just like, y'all got hit by a swarm of bugs.
Yep. And now you got to figure out what to do with yourselves. Mm-hmm. Can't go to the pub.
Yeah,
that's not the solution.
I will also throw out, it is possible that instead of the rot grubs that David was using the carrion stalker, because the carrion stalker is another, it's a tiny monstrosity that can, it doesn't hit real hard, but it does have it can, like, it has an ability called Larval Burst, which is similar to the Rot Grub thing.
That sounds bad.
It's not good. You have to make a DC. It basically releases a bunch of larvae in a 10-foot radius sphere centered on itself. Every creature has to make a DC 13 con save or be poisoned. And then a creature poisoned in this way takes 2d6 poison damage at the start of each of its turns. It's any effect that cures disease or removes the poison condition instantly kills the larvae in the creature, ending the effect. So it's different. It's not fire with this one. But it's the same situation where, like, if you're reduced to 0 hit points by the infestation or you start your turn with 0 hit points, you die, the larvae remain in the corpse, and then they survive to become, or one of them survives to become another
Alice's
carrion
poor
stalker.
Face.
Yeah, just imagine the face that you're making on hearing the words larval burst, and that's just my face for the last few minutes. Yeah,
it's not a good phrase. It's
just those
not
two words together, just unpleasant. The other thing actually I was thinking of just now is Sturges. I remember being a part of a campaign and being attacked by Sturges in that campaign, and they are so irritating, and they do that thing where they get attached and they're more like blood drain parasitic, quite like vampiric. Mm-hmm. But
like mosquitoes.
Yeah, like, but big bat sized mosquitoes that drink blood. And they look like almost like tiny little pterodactyl bats with proboscises that just drain blood, and they get attached. And because they're so tiny, they have like a really high AC because they're so dexterous, and it's like really, really hard to hit them. But when you do, they don't have very many hit points. So you can get rid of them if you manage to land a hit. But when they're on people, that's really difficult without consequences. So they're also very annoying. That reminded me of those creatures as well. It feels like David's done that thing where he's taken inspiration from lots of different areas of D&D monsters and smashed them together into one disgusting parasite.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And without giving too many explicit spoilers or anything for later episodes, do we think that this swarm is what do we think the larger implications of a dangerous swarm like this are? Do you think it's just like, do you think it's maybe one of those like, there's something wrong with the land? Or do you think it's more one of those like, it's just some bad bugs. Just avoid those bugs. They're bad. They're real bad.
But it's quite interesting that, I mean, they were warned about the moving lights and things before they went in, but it is quite interesting that it's in like the Crown's Wood. I don't know whether that's sort of like an intentional, like there's rot within the crown, like maybe.
Something rotten in the state of Denmark.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something rotten this way comes.
Oh.
That's not the phrase, but there's a play called Something Rotten, so.
But there is something where if it were any other DM, I'd be like, that's probably a random encounter on a random encounter table based on that terrain. But it's David, so I don't trust that. I think David's doing something. And maybe, again, maybe this is my heightened paranoia, but every time I thought, oh, what a random thing with no consequences. Big consequences. Come back down the line. Been part of a bigger story. So I do wonder if it's part of building some story in there about, you know, are these creatures naturally occurring? Have they always been part of the landscape of the Crown's Wood? Are they just sort of one of those parasitic species that are, it's a dangerous wood? Or have they evolved or been placed there or been, has a creature been tampered with to create them and those released into the Crown's Wood? Like they're an invasive species or, you know, what's going on and what is that telling us about what's happening in the wider world?
That would make sense. It does feel like it's something newer just because of Enkidu having to like talk to rangers and get like the special map and the fact that the Woodstock people were so paranoid. Like if it was part of their lives, they'd have better ways of dealing with it than just, oh, find the Grove Mother and her moving fox statues. Like, yeah, it feels new.
That's a good point. Yeah, because if there are experienced rangers in those woods, they would know what the particular dangers were and how to survive them quite well, or how to at least know to avoid them or have some kind of way of warding it off. But yeah, maybe that's a hint that they're not so naturally occurring or are quite a new species that's appeared in the last however many years.
Yeah.
Even Wib not wanting them to come in, it's understandable that you wouldn't want them like an infestation, but it's interesting that if these were like a naturally occurring thing that were known to exist, you would think that the town would have some quarantine protocols.
Yeah.
Or like would have protocols for dealing with them. That indicates to me that perhaps there isn't. Like, for example, in Europe, people hunted boars long enough that they eventually made boar spears because they realized one of the threats of hunting a boar is that if you hit it with the spear, it'll impale itself on the spear to get to you. And then you die horribly and painfully. So they put a little bar on it to stop the boar from running up the spear. Like people will make adaptations over time. So and in countries where there are like parasites and those sorts of things, people will make, you know, they'll come up with remedies. They'll come up with ways to try and avoid it. There will be oftentimes religious practices or rites to avoid that.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's even a natural selection thing.
Even as simple as like mosquito nets. Like,
yeah, exactly. Simple. People will create stuff or like I know in some parts of Africa, they have the horse or the zebra hair or animal like things that they'll whack to get rid of the bugs. People will come up with ways to deal with
burning certain herbs to like, you know, because smoke keeps certain types of bugs away and, you know, or makes them easier to get rid of or, you know, that kind of thing.
Or just sort of some sort of goggle that you wear or like blindfold that you wear so you don't get like hypnotized by the moving lights and start walking towards them. Because that seems to be like the biggest peril
Yeah. Some sort of anti-charm.
Yeah.
Something or other. Maybe you can hire an elf guide, somebody who has like resistance to charm abilities.
Yeah.
Different things like that.
Like a talisman or something, you know, like a small enchanted mm-hmm. talisman. You'd think they would, if it were something they were used to, they'd have figured something out like that.
Yeah. Like they would hire a cleric to stay in Woodstock to make holy water so that they can just sell it like it's on a tap.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's what makes me think it's a more recent thing.
Yeah.
But no fantasy jungle juice to...
Yeah.
Nope.
No fantasy paladin.
No fantasy
who can
deet.
Just use Lay on Hand to remove diseases. Because I'm pretty sure with Lay on Hands, I think it's like if you use 5 points of Lay on Hands healing,
you
can just cure a creature of disease.
Yeah, and paladins are also just like automatically immune to...
Exactly.
They're like, I don't get diseases anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And at their high level, they can give advantage on. I think they can either make you immune to charm or give everybody advantage on charm effects, mm-hmm. saves against charm effects.
Yeah.
So the thing that Grace was really annoyed that she's one level away from, was it purifying herself? Does that apply to other people as well? Can she do that to other people?
No, it's only herself.
Yes.
I think it's called like purity of body or something like that.
Yeah.
Where it's like, I think she's completely immune. Monks become completely immune to like disease at like level 10.
Amazing. David getting it this well. In now then.
Yeah.
Not going to be able to do that in the next level.
And I think that's also why the damage was so bad is because what are they? Level 8? Level 9?
Level 9. Yeah.
You got to hammer them at that point.
Yeah.
Like
they're getting tough.
That's strong.
They're getting tough. Yeah. This is quite a tricky. I think once you start getting towards like level 10 through I would say like 13 or 14, at least when I've ever DM'd, I find those levels really, really hard to DM for in terms of challenge ratings of combat, because it's like I can't go all out level 20 like I'm gonna throw a Tarrasque at you and see what you're gonna do, but at the same time I can't, everything else is like too easy, so it's like how to make these combats challenging without just adding more enemies.
Yeah.
So this is a really, I think, tricky moment where you can't be like, an owlbear, and everyone's like, oh no, this is really hard. But you also can't be like, an ancient dragon. And they'll be like, okay, we're immediately dead. So it's that kind of sweet spot of like, how do you get enemies that are suitably challenging, but also are not a guaranteed TPK?
Yeah, and the trick is, and you can see this, if for anybody who's played Baldur's Gate 3, you can actually see them do it a lot of times.
I want to play Baldur's Gate 3 so bad.
Oh, it's real good. You should try it out.
I want it so bad.
I made Dwayne and Gwendolyn in there.
Get out. Oh my god, can you please take screenshots and put them on the internet, please?
Yeah, I'll have to put them in the Discord.
Yes.
Because can't remember which one, I think I made both of them, but I'll see. Who I have on my save files, but in that so a lot of the tricks they use are terrain. Terrain is a huge one. So if you have, for example, terrain of various levels, then pushing people off of stuff becomes a very viable strategy in that game. But like terrain that, for example, forces people into a specific formation. So for example, say the party is walking through a forest and they get ambushed. What if everybody there who's ambushing them is in the trees and they have set traps on the ground level to give the party, for example, difficult terrain or something to even restrain them potentially? Like they're trying to limit the party's mobility and they have increased mobility because they're in the trees and are hidden. Then you immediately have the party at a severe disadvantage. And even if even if they're like a level 8 party, if the bad guys, you have a number of bad guys who outnumber the party and are even if they're like CR 2 or 3, if they're able to ensnare enough of the party and keep hidden, you have a potentially challenging combat.
That is a very
different
good
things
point.
Like that.
I love the idea that you could take a relatively easy combat and then just go, and the floor is lava. And that would just make everything so much harder.
Mm-hmm. If you give them if you give the enemies a huge mobility advantage over the party, that can really change things up. Because, for example, in this particular party, let's see, at least 2 party members would have a rough time with ranged combat.
That's
like
true.
Enkidu and Juna can still blast. Gaius isn't really blasty. He's more like support and buff type stuff. Gwendolyn, she's melee.
Yeah.
She's got to get in close.
Yeah.
So if you can keep her away, then, you know, or for example, a silence spell.
Yes.
If you drop a silence spell or a cone of silence,
your spell
you basically neutralize. Yeah. You neutralize almost the entire party.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause they're all very magical.
Yeah.
And if you take away the verbal component of spells, you know, they're impossible to cast. So yeah, I guess ways of restraining different elements of their abilities.
Yeah.
Or the other thing I think that what David's done is give the enemies special abilities that have ongoing effects if you are hit by mm-hmm. them, which is also pretty cool.
Yeah. Like a bleed effect. Yeah. I know there are certain weapons in D&D that if you get hit with them, you can basically wound a creature and they take 1d4 necrotic damage at the beginning of their turns. And if you have, say, 5 or 6 people who actually use in who understand how the mechanics of D&D work. Like, and when I say people, I mean the NPCs. They understand that in D&D, you should focus fire. What happens if your only close range fighter gets swarmed by 6 people who all stab her, and then she takes 6d4 damage up front, and then on her turn takes another 6d4 necrotic damage, and it just keeps getting, you know what yeah. I mean, it just keeps stacking.
Yeah.
Especially if they have disengage abilities, then it starts to be like, oh, now the party's having to focus their time trying to like track them down but heal her. It gets really messy.
Yeah
That kind of stuff is really
and
also legendary resistances and reactions. Yeah. That's another one.
Yeah Absolutely. I think it's just like building that complexity into combat, you know, at this level is I think where it starts to get really exciting.
Yeah.
Because you can start,
you have to get creative
stuff. Yeah.
So we're going to get even more bug level inventiveness. Hopefully not as many bugs, but this sort of creativity.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's what David's good at.
The campaign is just them fighting bugs.
Yeah.
Oh God, no.
Yeah. I have to say that after the body horror of the bug fight and its consequences, the Grove Mother atmosphere was very, very welcome.
Yes.
It was very cozy and calming in comparison.
And I really love the whole Luckbringer, Wilder Queen vibe. Like the tree, the carving is such a gorgeous image. And then he brought in this music, I think, when the Grove Mother was doing the ritual, which sort of sounded a little bit like folk horror, but in a good way. Like, you know, the really sort of fun, like Wicker Man kind of music. It just sort of had that sort of slight oddness to it. I really loved what he did with the music there. It was gorgeous.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, David's music is always top tier.
Yeah.
It's incredible, but it just keeps getting more sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
It's so cool.
He's really on point.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Shout out also for bringing back the Dwayne theme.
Yeah.
I forgot to mention that.
Yeah. It's those subtle touches that it's like, I don't know if I know many other D&D podcasts that do that kind of detailed sound design in that sense.
Mm.
You know, it's quite a unique feature of No Small Roles to me.
Yeah.
And it's lovely. Really lovely.
Yeah. More D&D podcasts should have their DM be a composer. Yeah, it's just real easy. Just find a composer, have him be your DM. Get John Williams to be the DM for your D&D podcast.
John Williams, but also really, really good storyteller.
Turns out John Williams, world-class DM. In his 90s, never better.
I almost made a really terrible joke, which was, let's get him on the horn and ask him.
Oh.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. That's for all you music nerds who are into John Williams.
Can we have a rim shot, but that's just timpani and a gong instead of a drum set?
The most dramatic rim shot.
Is there any more that we want to discuss about episode 78?
I was getting favorite moments of overall vibes. Like,
oh yeah, let's do that.
Is now the time to discuss, like, if you could choose a favorite moment, what would it be?
Oh.
It's Dwayne.
Yeah, obviously.
I liked when Dwayne showed up. that was my favorite.
Well, it was just like, it was
I
Dwayne.
May be slightly biased. But that was my favorite.
Yeah, that's totally understandable. Because I guess being Dwayne is like fun to do as fun to listen to. So multiple layers.
Yeah, because a lot of times, because it's a surprise for the cast as well.
Yeah.
Like, they'll approach me and be like, oh, only one or two of us know that we're approaching you right now. So it's fun to be like, sometimes they'll send me recordings of the rest of the cast, like, responding to when they hear me do something. And it's like, oh.
That's so cute.
Yeah.
So cute.
And I'll get, like, as a fan of the show, I'll get, like, small snippets of, like, this is what's happening. But they won't tell me all the context. It'll just be like, oh, you get a message from Juna, just, you know, while you're chilling. And I'm like, oh, okay, sounds good.
How about you, Alice?
Got a few, which is amazing given how much I hated some of these episodes. It was amazing the moment where we saw Orin, obviously. That was so exciting. Oh, and I think it's really funny that when Petra speaks through Orin, she still sounds like Petra. Like, it's been really fun imagining him going around talking with her voice for the last week. And I like the bouquet going into butterflies. That was nice. And I really like the grove. I think it's lovely. Oh, and the name Wib, obviously, is a huge...
It's a top-tier name.
Top-tier name. How about you?
Would that we could all be Wib.
Yeah. Would that we could.
Oh, God. It was a really great run of episodes. It was, like, really gripping. I think it's just going to have to be the Guy and Eustace interaction. I think it was just so cute.
Yeah.
It was just so cute and, like, funny, adorable, awkward but not awkward. It was just... and unexpected. Although it is always really lovely, I think, like I said earlier, when... there's ascending to another character and then it's actually the guest player's voice coming in an unexpected way rather than David doing an impression. So that,
yeah.
I think it's just such a lovely little flavor thing dropping in and being like, oh, it is Dwayne. Yeah. It's his actual voice. Like, it's really cool. So Guy and Eustace together. I think the ship, the ship might have to happen.
Yeah.
Does anyone have any theories? I guess because we've got two more episodes that we've already heard, it's maybe not too getting too into what happens in those. But does anyone have any like theories about what might be in store?
I think that I've already kind of said one, which is that I think that those bugs may be tied to some larger issue going on. And also, I will say, I predict that at some point, the party will unite with Gwendolyn's mother, and they will go on possibly some sort of adventure, either in Orcosh or in relation to Orcosh. And that Carhildr, I really have to get used to saying Carhildr.
Carhildr.
And that Carhildr storyline is going to come to a head.
Yeah.
I think that will be resolved in some way.
Yeah. I'm so curious about, because they're sort of heading towards Enkidu's kind of demonologist situation. And I just have this really uncomfortable sense of the whole Erida thing running in the background and what is going to emerge around the demonology and the understanding of what's happened to Enkidu, both pre where we meet him in the campaign and post Erida, like, and how that ties in with the larger political picture as well. And is there something linked to what's going on in the Crownswood and the Henges? And like, what does it all mean? What does it mean?
Yeah, there's a definite sense of like convergence happening, I think, with like Chargelt being in the... oh, this is from episode 80, so I shouldn't probably say it, but like, we know that Chargelt's in the palace, we know that Sigrid's in the palace, like, and Enkidu said he was being sort of drawn in that direction as well. Like, they're gonna go to the demonologist first, but he's like there's a definite sense that somewhere in my body I'm being sent that way. So Erida must be sort of heading over there as well. So it just sort of starts to feeling like all the bits are getting tied back in.
Where's my red string? I should go back to my board and put all the string on it and figure it out.
We are all Charlie Kelly on this show.
Seriously, that's just what the Superfans hub looks like. It's just like a web of red string. You like can't open the door. It's just all
yeah. Instead of yelling Carol, we're just like Erida, Erida.
Yup. Oh man, I can't wait to see what happens next.
Yeah, me too.
It's always so exciting, and like you said, it does feel like things are beginning to really coalesce and like big pieces are falling into place in a way that is, the momentum feels like it's gathering in some way.
It does.
So cool.
Yeah, we're nearing, I think, I don't know, it feels like honestly this could go on for like another 80 episodes
easily,
like with just how things have gone, because it has been a lot of slow burn.
Yeah.
So unless they drastically ramp up the pace, I could see this going on for like another 80 episodes.
Oh, for sure. There's so much. But there's just so much.
Yeah.
There's so much to resolve.
Yeah.
Well, there's so much to discover inevitably, before we resolve.
Yeah. I think inevitably they're going to have to leave stuff on the table because like you can't go to every part of the world. You know what I mean? It's just going to be, we're probably not going to get to see some of these really cool places that we're like, oh, you know, because it's just not going to be time.
The Skyrim obsessive in me is really annoyed about that.
Maybe there'll be sequel series.
Every inch of the map. I want to find every single henge and every single orc camp and every single city. And I want to have them all mapped out on my little map and have the little diamond next to them saying, completed.
We'll get the achievement.
Yeah, exactly. You have spent 700 hours in no small roles. Are you okay?
I feel like we are nearing that sort of number.
Yeah.
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 Because for this, we have to listen to every episode like twice, potentially.
Yeah. Yeah, we do.
Should we wrap it up?
Yeah. Let's do it.
Let's see. I don't know. Get out of here. Leave. Stop listening to this episode. The episode's ending. Go listen to episodes 79 and 80.
Yeah.
This is a pleasure.
We'll see you next time. Just go listen to more No Small Roles.
Be gone.
And go sign up to their Patreon.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's great.
Go sign up for the Patreon.
Because then you get more content. And it's great. It's all great content.
Yes.
And you get episodes early.
And you get to help support the show.
Yes.
Yeah.
So they can make more of it.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Should we do the Anon for now?
Yeah, let's do it for it.
All right.
Anon for now.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.